Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to the Ruler podcast. My name's Jack Thurston, and this is the podcast for issue 50 of Ruler magazine, which is something of a landmark issue, marking half a century of the magazine in terms of issues, if not years. And towards the end of the podcast, there'll be a competition to win quite a nice prize that relates to the 50th edition of Ruler. But first, I'd like to introduce my guest, who joins me down a Skype line to discuss this issue of the magazine. His name is Edward Pickering. He's a cycling journalist and author and making his debut on the Ruler podcast. Ed, I think it's probably quite lucky that you're down a Skype line, because I've got a stinking cold. Which is actually, it struck me that it's one of those things that makes your life, well, make your life, particularly as a journalist who goes out and talks to a lot of professional cyclists, and you have done a feature interview with Mark Cavendish in this magazine, which we'll come to in a bit. But having a stinking cold is a no-no, isn't it? It's taboo.
It is, yeah. I've never actually been in that situation, which I've heard from other journalists, where after shaking hands with them, it's actually a directeur sportif put some antiseptic gel on his hands after having shaken hands. I don't know if he was making some kind of statement or whether it really was a health-related thing. But yeah, riders and the cycling bubble as a whole is paranoid about germs, because like any enclosed society, diseases pass quickly between individuals.
And, you know, they're all on the very edge of their immune systems as finely tuned athletes.
No different from us as journalists, I'd say, although we're not the finely tuned athletes that they are, but the lifestyle can be tiring.
Okay, well, let's start the podcast with our selection of favourite photographs, or a favourite photograph or photo spread from the issue. You can go first.
Yeah, I have a favourite photograph. It's on page 83.
Yep.
It's Alex Steeder playing the harmonica along with... I assume a local French chap of some description, probably at the Tour de France start village. It doesn't actually say. But I love the kind of impromptu, off-diary nature of this photograph. You know, this is an elite athlete, presumably at the Tour de France, the pinnacle of cycling, world cycling. And there's an impromptu jam between him playing the harmonica and a guy playing the violin. I just think... it's the kind of thing you don't see anymore on the Tour de France. And it's also the kind of thing that I love about cycling. It's what makes cycling a little bit different in my eyes to other sports, the kind of atmosphere and ambiance you maybe don't get so much these days at the start of the Tour. It kind of demonstrates what a cultural event it is, as well as a sporting spectacle.
Good choice. Well, my choice is on page 35, and this is actually from your story. This is a picture by Robert Wyatt, and it's the opening spread of your profile interview with Mark Cavendish, and it shows Mark on his bike in the street, I guess somewhere in Tuscany.
Pistoia.
And there's a woman who's actually in focus behind Mark, sort of in a blur, and she's just got on her bike, having been shopping by the looks of things. It's a sort of typical shopper bike, although I do notice that it carries the Vina brand, which is a brand of some prestige in cycling.
And I quite like
the various juxtapositions of the professional cyclist, the middle-aged lady doing her shopping, and just how it brings cycling together in a single photograph. And I guess, you know, you could take it further and talk about how, I suppose, originally bike racing came out of a desire of bicycle making companies to promote their bicycles. And generally, the bikes that were being raced were not the bikes that were being sold. And they would try and sell a butcher a sturdy bike bearing a brand of the same brand that had just won the Tour de France, on the basis that the butcher's bike would somehow be carrying some of the virtues of that race machine.
Yeah, it's a beautiful photograph for those very reasons. I also like the fact she's not taking any notice of the kind of sporting hero who's the photographs. I remember this one being taken. It was actually taken from inside the car. We were just waiting to go on the ride with Cavendish and Sabatini, and Cavendish was just resting up against the car, propped up against it while waiting for Sabatini to go and change kit. Sabatini was in the wrong kit for his Cannondale's, for his team, so he had to go change in case he got photographed wearing the wrong kit, get into trouble with his sponsor. But yeah, I love the photograph because it does juxtapose the kind of the traditional and the modern, and the kind of old and the new, and the kind of also the contrast between the fact that Cavendish is kind of wearing space age cycling kit and she's just kind of wearing her normal clothes and on an old or maybe even new shopping bike to go and do her errands around town.
I guess there are parts of the world where it is quite normal to see a professional or elite racing cyclist, you know, out and about doing their training, because we're used to seeing them in races, but they have to do all those training miles and they have to do them somewhere.
Exactly, yeah. They, you know, Cavendish lives in the town of Corata. He lives in the town. It's not like there's a footballer's wife style, you know, community of rich athletes living away from the town. Cavendish lives in the town. Pistoia, which is where the photograph was taken, just down the road, is where Sabatini lives. Sabatini lives just a few doors along from where this photograph was taken. And it's just a row of streets and Sabatini lives in the town centre. The photograph where further on in the feature where he's kissing a baby and there's a woman there, that's Sabatini's wife, and they just bumped into them again in the town centre as they're heading off the training ride. That's true that cycling has always taken place in the general infrastructure rather than in specially built stadia, and you know that's the connection between cycling and the people.
And so why did Mark Cavendish choose to live in Tuscany, in Italy? I mean, he's a Manxman. He races for a Belgian team. Why Italy?
I think he generally likes it there. I don't blame him. It's beautiful and the sun shines. I mean, it's kind of wonderfully hilly and not quite mountainous, but hilly enough for perfect cycling. The roads are nice. There's a cycling culture there. But Quadrata is where the British Cycling Academy, set up by Rod Ellingworth, where Cavendish actually studied or raced as an under 23. That's where it was based, and he's accepted enough by the local people. I mean, he sees it as a second home. I think he does also count the Isle of Man as his home. He's a very very proud Manxman, and he also kind of lives. He has family connections in Essex these days with his wife and daughter and stepson. So I think with Tuscany, it's the perfect place for him to live, and he also knows it very well. I think that makes it a great place for him to live and train.
And so, what was the instigation for this visit that you paid? I mean, obviously he's had a terrible season. Was he keen to talk to Ruler, or was it a matter of Ruler, you know, badgering him for a bit of time so you could go out and spend some time with him?
Always a bit of both. I think Cavendish is actually always, he's always happy to talk. He's a very good talker, and he's always a pleasure to interview with one proviso. He's a pleasure to interview because he's genuinely passionate about cycling, and he's a very good communicator of the way cycling is. The only proviso is that he doesn't suffer fools gladly, and you've got to be very well prepared with your facts and questions with Cavendish. If you ask him questions that he's been asked before, or he perceives you as maybe not having done your research, he switches off very quickly. But when he's on, he's a fantastic communicator. Cycling, I think, yes, he's had the best year. I mean, he had good form through the year. He's won stages in races like the Tour Turkey, Tour California, and he was riding well, and then obviously crashed out of the Tour de France and never got a chance to show himself against Marcel Kittel. So he's happy to talk about, you know, the fact it, and be honest about the fact it's been a challenging year, but he's also happy to talk about the fact that being away from cycling, being forced to miss the Tour de France, has rekindled his love for it, and he, you know, he wants to go back and prove himself. Proving himself is what he really enjoys doing, and does to kind of, you know, for his, you know, sense of self. So he's happy to talk about, you know, coming back, facing the challenge of riding against, sprinting against Kittel, and proving that he's still a good sprinter.
When people talk about something being rekindled, it always flags in my mind the idea that it must have somehow gone out, the spark must have gone, or the fire must have gone out.
Maybe I used the wrong word, but he was saying before this year's tour that he wasn't sure how long he'd keep it going, and, you know, see after 3-4 seasons how it was going. Whereas he said now very definitely he thinks this is a good halfway mark in his career, and he's been a professional since 2007, so that would give him another 6-7 years as a professional cyclist. And he's very competitive, so he would never want to be a cyclist just to make up the numbers. So maybe not a case of losing something and getting it back, but yeah, rekindling the passion and realizing how much he loved it by the fact that he missed it.
A great deal of what went wrong this season can be put down to bad fortune and crashes, but hanging over it all, I guess, is the question of is Mark Cavendish still the fastest man on two wheels? And now that there's a lot more competition, and we have Marcel Kittel, who's been winning the head-to-heads, hasn't he?
He has. Cavendish has never actually beaten Kittel in a straight-up sprint where both of them have gone for the win. But it's interesting. I mean, Kittel is evidently the best sprinter Cavendish has had to come up against. André Greipel's given him some problems and beaten him in the past, but I always got the sense that if everything went right for Cavendish, he would beat Greipel. Whereas with Kittel, I think Kittel's formidable. He's extremely fast, and worryingly for Cavendish, he seems to be able to hold that top speed for longer. But this is a kind of rivalry that it demonstrates that we as cycling fans and sports fans have quite short memories in general, because for a while Cavendish was the best sprinter, and it was evident he was the best. And then Kittel came along, and now we all think he's the best, and that's fine, because somebody has to be the best. But I think Cavendish sees that Kittel has vulnerabilities, and one of those is the ability to conserve energy over 3 weeks, and that's something Cavendish has always been very good at. You could see that this year's tour, Kittel won the first sprint easily, the second sprint slightly less easily, and then by the third sprint, he wasn't winning by much at all. And I think Cavendish sees a chink in his armour that in a straight-up sprint at the start of a grand tour, Kittel might be superior, but I think Cavendish will have ambitions to have a good run at Kittel in next year's tour or the Giro d'Italia. And it might take the third or fourth attempt to beat him, but I think it'll happen, and I think Cavendish believes that it'll happen, otherwise he wouldn't be going back to try and do it.
What's the strategy? Is it to focus on the end of the stage races, or is there a race plan as well with his team?
I'd say Cavendish is now in the position where he doesn't have to take responsibility to organise a sprint at the end. For a long time, because he was the leader, other teams relied on when he was with HTC in Colombia for them to bring the sprint together, and then Omega Pharma. Whereas now, everyone's definitely going to look at Giant Shimano to organise the sprints. And Cavendish can play off that. He's done a lot of track racing in the past. He knows how to handle himself in a sprint. And I think he'll play off Kittel a lot more and sit behind him and, you know, use Kittel's team to put himself into a position to sprint. And then, you know, maybe use his team at the very end of a sprint to bring him past Kittel. And it's what Robbie McEwen used to do with Alessandro Petacchi and Mario Cipollini. Their teams would lead out the sprint, and he would sit on them He'd have to fight for their wheel, which is not an easy thing to do, but he'd sit on them and then use his jump to get past them. Whether Cavendish can do that with Kittel, I'm not sure, because Kittel, you know, like I said before, is extremely fast and can hold his speed for a long time.
And he also employs a sweeper, which is a new role that I hadn't heard of in a sprint train. It's the rider who rides behind the designated team leader in the sprints to block a freelancer from hopping on the wheel.
That's right, and it's a pointer. It's a sticky point with Cavendish, because he obviously collided with Tom Velers, who's Kittel's sweeper. I'm in the sprint. As Feathers was coming back after having done his work, Cavendish perceives it that he drifted and wasn't, you know, he wasn't looking where he was going and drifting backwards, which is very dangerous when you're in the middle of a sprint, because everyone else is going forwards at 70 kilometres an hour, sorry. So it's a controversial tactic, purely because it's not somebody who's trying to win the sprint. It's somebody who's basically trying to keep anyone else from getting close to the sprinter. It's legitimate within the rules of the sport, but Cavendish certainly doesn't smile upon it as a tactic, especially he's been on the receiving end of it.
And one of the points that you mention in the article is that Cavendish doesn't have and hasn't had since HTC a team that's built entirely around him to help him win his sprints. He's been with Sky, who had other ambitions, and now with Omega Pharma, they also have other ambitions, although they have, you know, they do provide a strong sprint team for him. It's not all that they do.
No, exactly. It's actually a formidably strong team. When you look at the riders they've got Rigoberto Urán, who's capable of finishing on the podium of Grand Tours, has done so twice. They've got the new world champion, Michał Kwiatkowski, who's obviously having a fantastic season and will go on to even greater things. And they've got Tony Martin, who's former world time trial champion and multiple stage winner in the Tour de France. And they've got Tom Poonen and Nicky Terpstra, who are specialists in the cobbled and flat classics. So Cavendish is a bit crowded, but the team does seem to work okay for him. I think they have got a good lead out train. They've got Gert Stegmans, who was one of Robbie McEwen's trusted lead out men 9-10 years ago. He's very experienced, and they've got Mark Renshaw, who's also, you know, seen as one of the two or three best lead out final lead out men in the world. So Cavendish does have strong riders at his disposal, but you're right in that he doesn't have the whole team of eight riders in front of him in the way that Giant Shimano did for Kittel. Giant have got the luxury of having eight domestiques, all for Kittel winning stage at the Tour de France, and that's told. With their Grand Tour rider Warren Barguil getting better and better, that might change in the future, and it might change the sprinting dynamic. But at the moment, Cavendish is slightly outnumbered, and it showed, although he seemed very confident that he could and would have given Kittel a close run at the Tour de France this year had he not suffered from bad luck.
And do you think that he has recalibrated his expectations? Because he has had the most phenomenal series of seasons with huge numbers of victories, and maybe that is just an exceptional time. You know, maybe it's unrealistic to expect to be able to get back up to that level of winning, you know, five. Did he ever win six stages?
Yeah, he won six. Yeah, yeah. His most was six, and he averaged five. I think he won four in his first tour, six in his second, and then five in his third and fourth. Dipped down to three, and then two last year, and then none this year because he crashed out. Now, he was ahead of the game, and that's one of the reasons why he's phenomenally fast and talented as a sprinter, but he was also ahead of the game in terms of the preparation, the tactics, and the looking into the aerodynamics. And it's true that other teams have looked at what he's done. Everyone's wearing skin suits now. Everyone's got aerodynamic helmets. And those, I was told by, it was actually Rob Hales, Cavendish's personal assistant, who told me that those aerodynamic aids, especially the skin suits, benefit big riders much more than they do small riders. So again, that's actually turned into a disadvantage for Cavendish. But I think if Kittel were to have bad luck, then we could be looking at Cavendish winning five or six stages again. If Kittel turns up not on form and Cavendish has another great tour, then again, the tables could be turned. I think if all things remain equal, then it's going to be hard to repeatedly win five or six stages again for Cavendish. I think those days are over. He's no longer ahead of enough of the game that he could guarantee that. But I think he's confident he can outsprint anybody when he's feeling good and the tactics are right. And, you know, with a bit of luck, which you never want to rely on as a professional cyclist, but with a bit of luck, he could, you know, win multiple stages again. I don't see why not. And I still think he's probably, you know, I've got no evidence to suggest he's not, you know, still the second best sprinter in the world. While he has mellowed, there's still life in the old dog yet.
Well, that takes us to someone who I suppose we could genuinely describe as an old dog, Jens Vogt, who has set a new benchmark for the hour. I'm careful to say that he hasn't broken the hour record, and I got a little bit irritated on social media the other day during the hour attempt that people were saying yes, and the commentators were saying yes, he's breaking the hour record, which of course is not true. Ed, you are something of an expert on the hour, having written a book about how the contest was reignited in the 1990s with the battle between Chris Boardman and Graham O'Bree. And you've been out to see and talk with Jens Vogt after his successful setting of the new benchmark. Just fill us in on how the hour has been reignited as a sporting contest.
Well, it fizzled out partly because the riders were riding too far. The parallel I see is with I think the javelin in track and field athletics. People in the I think the 80s and 90s were throwing the javelin so far they had to keep making it heavier so that they wouldn't impale a poor unsuspecting member of the audience at the other end of the field or an unsuspecting 1500 meter runner as he's going round the bend. So they kept changing the weight of the javelin, which made the world javelin record as it is a kind of bit of a confusing situation. And the same things happened with the hour record. That Chris Boardman rode 56 kilometers in what's called the Superman position in the mid 90s, and it's pretty much accepted that nobody is ever going to get close to that, or nobody was ever going to get close to that record again. Especially since the UCI banned the Superman position, which was incredibly aerodynamic. So the UCI, to cut a long story short, Union Cycliste Internationale, the governing body, decided to divide the record into two different records. The ultimate hour record, which was Chris Boardman's 56-kilometre record, and then they reset the hour record to the athlete's hour, to the 49 kilometres that Eddie Merckx rode in 1972 or three, I'll have to check which year that is, 1972, I think. And it kind of died a death. Chris Boardman did actually break Eddie Merckx's record in the traditional position on drop handlebars, using no aerodynamic aids. But interest fizzled out in it. And
why did the interest fizzle out? Was that because the manufacturers had no interest in producing a bike that was from 1972, that there was no money to set one of these the records?
That's part of it. I mean, the hour takes a lot of support and research by the bike companies, and it's kind of a showcase for their technological development. So if the clock's been rewound to, you know, the steel frame, triangular frame era, then there's no interest for them. It's not just that, though. The record lost its luster and it became confusing. And I think amongst the athletes there, whereas it used to be one of the blue ribbons and the ultimate accolade for, you know, road cyclists to go and set the hour record, a lot of the greats of cycling have held the record in the past. So I think after the UCI's tinkering of the rules, it just became something that held no interest with them. And also to train on a drop handlebar bike to actually break the hour record takes quite a significant amount of time and effort. And it's time out of the season when they should be doing their day job of representing their sponsors and bike manufacturers. So it kind of fizzled out. And it was only when the UCI announced this spring that riders would be able to use modern technological equipment, including tri-bars, that interest was reignited. And the timing was perfect for Jens Vogt to really execute a publicity coup in announcing that he would do it as his kind of retirement swan song. So the fact that Vogt is so popular also helped, but the timing was perfect.
And so what now is the bike that you can ride in the hour?
Same as the Pursuit is. There are certain technological constraints, as there are with Pursuit bikes, that you can't have a monocoque one-piece frame. The wheels have to be the same size. But other than those, it's much more reasonable. And the bikes you see Pursuiters riding will be similar to the ones ridden in the hour. In fact, I think Vogt rode an off-the-peg time trial bike, Trek's time trial model, for the hour record. They didn't have time to build a whole new bike for the hour attempt, so he used a time trial bike, basically.
And so I guess the question is, as this is an event which is supposed to transcend time in the sense that one athlete can race against another athlete from another generation and see how they would do, has the importance of technology been removed from the equation, or will there be improvements such that in 10 years' time they may have to reboot it again?
I'm not sure. I mean, there may be. We don't know what the bike companies could come up with to kind of give themselves a little edge. There are quite a lot of regulations in place that the UCI put in place to kind of try and control that, but that it's a game in a way between the bike manufacturers and the UCI. I think there's going to be a reigniting of interest in it. I think names I've heard suggested as being very interested in the hour record are Alex Dowsett, who, as a Grand Tour time trial winning cyclist, would have a good hope of beating Jens Vogt's record. Fabian Cancellara has been interested in it on and off over the last couple of years. Tony Martin's interested, but I think Bradley Wiggins has gone as far as setting a date in June next year, I believe, to break the record on the back of his training for Paris-Roubaix. I think when he attacks it, he won't be a huge distance off Boardman's former record. I would say he'll definitely be north of 54.5 kilometres, and then from then it depends on how well he's focused on it. Vogt was the first to admit that all he's done is, as I say, set a benchmark. It's been nice timing for him, and now he doesn't expect to keep it when, you know, younger riders who are more specialised in time trials go for it. And I personally think Wiggins is the one who'll set a very challenging mark, because much as Tony Martin's the best time trialist of his generation, Wiggins has the track experience, and being able to ride on a track is not just a case of pointing a wheel in a straight line and pedalling away. It takes quite a lot of mastery of the G-force and the way the track affects your position and form over the course of an hour that's important. And I think because Wiggins developed as a track rider, I think he'll have the edge on Tony Martin if they both went for it.
Well, Jens Vogt does feature in this issue of Ruler, 50th issue, on page 63, a picture of the young Jens Vogt. And this is in quite a nice feature in the magazine, where the editors have got quite a large handful of professional riders from different eras to write a letter to their younger selves, offering advice or observations. Or it's pretty free form, isn't it? But quite a nice exercise.
It is. There's some great advice, and some advice which wouldn't account for me. I like some of the shorter ones as well. I love the Bernard Eisel one, which basically it says, not really any point in me advising the 21-year-old Bernie, because 21-year-old Bernie knows best. And I think that's quite a nice acknowledgement of his character. And also the Sean Yates one, which is as brief and succinct as the man himself is generally in interviews, just says, don't change anything, just be a little more serious.
And don't eat so much cake.
Yeah, which kind of sums up Sean Yates'
diet and what to eat and that kind of thing, which has changed an enormous amount, I guess, over the years. And we get a taste for that, excuse the pun, in Ian Cleverley's feature at the back of the magazine, where he spends 6 days, I guess, or 6 visits at least, during the Vuelta a España with various team chefs. And I guess the team chef is probably a new role in cycling. I was talking about the sprint sweeper being a new role. Can you recall when you noticed that teams were having their own chefs as part of the team?
Not exactly. That's a very good question. It's something that's kind of happened in my mind by osmosis, because I'm focused generally on the riders and the racing. It's kind of crept up on me. I remember a few years ago seeing a photograph of, I think it was Europcar, had a little kind of portable restaurant. It had an extra large camper van, which the sides opened out, and it made a restaurant for the riders to eat in. I remember being quite struck by that. That's maybe 4 or 5 years ago. And it's kind of most been visible to me at Team Sky, because I used to follow their chef on Twitter. He tweeted every meal that he did for the riders, and it was quite an insight into the everyday life of the team, that it's not just a case of getting up, racing and sitting down at the end of the day. There's a whole infrastructure which supports them. And I think, because somebody once described cyclists to me as basically industrial strength digestive systems, because they don't have to pack away a lot of food over the course of a 3-week grand tour. And so the chef's job is not just to replace all the nutrients and do all the boring stuff about X amount of protein and Y amount of carbohydrate. They've got to make it taste nice, otherwise the riders go mad. So I like seeing whether there's a tension between keeping the riders happy with the taste and variety of the food and giving them what they need to fulfil their duties.
Let's just quickly mention the review of the covers of Rouleau, celebrating the magazine's 50th issue. The cover of Rouleau is something that has, from the very beginning, set it apart from other cycling magazines. I mean, I think a lot of us would like to think that the internal contents of the magazine also set the magazine apart from other cycling magazines. But the cover definitely is different. What did you think when you first saw Rouleau? Because you've only started writing for it relatively recently. I think the last issue and this issue, is that right?
That's right. Yeah, the last two issues I've had features in. Yeah, because I came from a background in much more commercial magazines, where there are certain kind of opinions within the company about the way the magazines should look and the way magazines attract people's attention, that I do remember being quite taken aback when I can't remember what I saw my first cover of the Rouleau, but I think it was a cobblestone. It might have been that issue 9, which is in this month's magazine. And I remember thinking, being quite taken aback by that, because it went against every single thing I'd ever been told, that you need bright colours to attract attention, that you need a kind of list of what's in the magazine in order to entice people to open it and buy it. So a picture of some cobblestones and just the title of the magazine seemed to me to be quite a departure. I liked it as well, obviously, because I like the idea of more in-depth features and long features and the emphasis on photography that Rouleau has had. So it communicates that very well.
And I'm afraid it does seem as though the bean counters at Rouleau have had to take the advice from that you described of having the table of contents, because if you do see Rouleau on the newsstands, you will see that it has a different cover, which is a little bit, I mean, it's still different from most cycling magazines and perhaps not quite so garish, but it definitely does have that sort of table of contents type of thing.
Very true. Although I will say that this month's edition, which I believe is designed by Paul Smith, is that right?
Yeah, well, that's the subscriber issue. So if you're a subscriber, you get Rouleau as it's meant to be, whereas if you pick it up in a newsstand, then you get the extra bit that's put there to make it sit more happily alongside all the other cycling magazines. So it's clear where I'm going with this.
Yes.
It makes sense to subscribe as you get a better magazine and you pay a bit less, I think.
The Paul Smith cover is beautiful. And it's also, dare I say it, quite garish and very brightly coloured. So it's
And it's also a little bit naughty. It's a bit naughty, isn't it? Slightly naughty? The placement of that saddle?
Maybe, if you see things that way. I'm holding it up in different ways, and I don't know. I just think it's a beautiful colour cover.
Yes, right. I've got a filthy mind. It's true.
Now, I mentioned at the start of the show there'd be a chance to win something that relates to this issue of Ruler, and I'll keep you in suspense no longer. The prize, and it's a good one, is a limited edition print of the cover of Ruler that we've been talking about by Paul Smith. That's something to put in your art treasure trove. And you can win it if you answer correctly the following question and are the one who has the correct answer who is drawn out of the hat by the folks at Ruler. The question is this. What is the name of Paul Smith's first cycling club? What's the name of Paul Smith's first cycling club? And send that to competition@ruler.cc. That's competition@ruler.cc. And the editor's decision will be final. Good luck. We're nearly done now for this podcast. Ed, thank you very much for joining me. Scratchy though the Skype line has been, we've enjoyed your insights.
Elsewhere in this issue, you can read the usual columns by Johnny Green, Matt Seaton, Robert Miller, as well as the latest brief history of cycling photography, where Duncan Forbes looks at photographs of victory. And there is a feature by Colin O'Brien about very fancy Campagnolo wheels that Ed and I have decided that, not being the strongest on the technology side, we'll skip over entirely for the purposes of this podcast.
Probably best. All I can say about them is that they look very round.
Well, that's important, isn't it, as we know. Okay, Ed, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And finally, as this is something of a celebratory moment in the history of Ruler, we're going to play out with a few of the best bits from the podcast. There haven't been 50 podcasts. I don't know how many podcasts there have been. I think some way over 20. We trawled around to find a few tidbits that might amuse you. So until next time, thanks for listening. From me, Jack Thurston. Goodbye.
Have you seen a dog, Gwynbo?
In a car, in a Land Rover, lots of times. No, a dog on foot.
I had him by that, not long, about...
Well, is it a sheepdog?
An old English sheepdog, grey, you know.
No, we've been here for about half an hour, I haven't seen him.
Yeah.
If you want to borrow my bike, you can go and have a scoot round and see if you can find it.
Well, we'll keep an eye out for him. Shall we hang on to him if we see him come past? And yeah,
here's your Land Rover again.
Yeah, the Okay, no, sorry.
I think the people in the Land Rover might be lost.
I don't know. They keep going past with different cargo on board. Well, I thought people moved to the countryside to get away from the traffic.
You mentioned the curse of Ruler.
Yes, always.
What is the curse of Ruler?
I don't know who started the curse of Ruler. Tommy Vocker. I'm just thinking from a point of view of a rider. Was it Sylvain Chavanel?
It was Chavanel or Vocker or around that time. But basically, as soon as you put somewhere in the magazine, a big win will surely follow. It's a total freakery, you know. We don't claim to be any great pundits. That's just the way it is. And the thing is, we have such a long time scale on things. You can interview a guy and it might not appear till 6 months down the line. But it's quite a handy tool, especially in the days of Twitter. Oh, look.
We've still got a Julian Dean interview scheduled in, and he's retired. So
yeah, well,
we do that,
he's
maybe
due for a comeback.
Yeah, due for a comeback.
You know, this time it's Marcel Kittel. Good old Andy McGrath got hold of Marcel at the Tour of Turkey, and sure enough, he's delivered three times so far.
Touch wood, I steer clear of crashes this year. I've been, you know, racing around Central Park and Prospect Park in Brooklyn and elsewhere. Yeah, and I've mostly been okay, except the first winter I was out here, I was riding around Central Park kind of very early in the morning, as cyclists do, people training seriously anyway. And I had a collision with a raccoon running across the road. I hit this raccoon going full bore, like 25 miles an hour plus, and you know, the raccoon bounced off, and I nearly caught it, but you know, went down, and I thought I'd done my shoulder as well, actually, but I wasn't too badly off. The raccoon, I found out later, was fine, by the way. I've seen it since. Its name is Fatty, and it is a very well-covered raccoon. I think it gets a very good diet in the Manhattan's Upper East Side next to Museum Mile.
And we got a column out of it, of course, as well.
That's so, right. You know, oh, I may have written about this. Oops. Yes.
These are photographs that have been published before. Johnny, you've got to run off and introduce somebody upstairs.
I have. This is pure madness, isn't it? Wonderful, yeah. Welcome to the wonderful world of poetry, or is it rock and roll? I never know. One minute.
We'll bring you back.
Sorry, boys.
So Johnny's gone upstairs to compare a night of performance poetry with John Cooper Clarke, amongst others, who he may... We're in his dressing room, actually, Ian. We found the gin.
I've been eating John Cooper Clarke's crisps.
Well, I can see John Cooper Clarke's Bakewell slices on the... That is an unhealthy rider over there, isn't it?
That's the usual. You always get that backstage. But
don't you specify what you'd like to have? If you're a star... I know you used to be in a band, but if you're a star of the level of John Cooper Clarke, presumably you can be quite specific. The Royal Festival Hall will presumably do their best to conform to your requirements.
Well, obviously the higher up you go, the more you can specify all that stuff. But a lot of people just don't, you know, who can be bothered? Who can be bothered? You get what you're given.
Should we have a look in the fridge?
Go on, listen.
Oh, there we go. Now, that was definitely specified. A couple of bottles of Sancerre.
Yeah.
And some tonic water.
That's not bad.
Diet tonic water.
That's not bad.
There's a lower fridge which has some non-diet tonic water and a salad. We're talking about Henri Cartier-Bresson's piece at the Veldive, Johnny. You're back. How are they upstairs? A good crowd?
It's a quiet, pensive, thoughtful crowd. It's a strange way to do an interview. This, well done, you boys. It's very maverick.
We're just winging it.
Upstairs, there's a huge hall full of people listening to poetry. It's brilliant. I'm toing and froing. I got lost at that point. A Spinal Tap moment. No. For a second, running back here. I love that photograph of Jacques Anquetil. A bloke I used to work with, who's now dead, called Ray Lowry, an artist. And he always had this expression that said, great hair begat great art. Measure a man by his barnet.
Let's just talk about the Tour of Britain, because you've both been with the tour this week, Andy in a press capacity and Tom on the other side of the fence. How's it been?
It's been a wild ride, yeah. I've enjoyed it. I suppose I was asking a few riders this morning about cheese, so maybe I'm starting to crack psychologically. But the
cheese.
Racing cheese, because we're sponsoring the competitivity award, so I thought it would be a nice angle to see what they've done with the cheese.
Well, how does the cheese relate to the competitivity?
Basically, we source local cheeses and we give them to the most attacking rider, the prize winner, at the end of every stage.
Gets a hunk of cheese.
Yes, yeah, normally a wheel of cheese. It turns out most of them haven't eaten theirs yet, but they are saving it for post-race.
Well, they're very calorie conscious these days, aren't they?
So yeah, I told one of them it would make him go faster, but he didn't really seem to agree.
Tom, you're an ex-pro. Do you think the offer of cheese... for combativity would have
made a marked difference to your cycling career?
No.
Extra incentive?
The only thing that would have been extra incentive would have been a pig for me, personally. A live piglet to slaughter as I wished and when I wished.
They do have that, don't they?
Yeah, in the Trobriand in France, they give that as the combativity award. And I believe that Guy originally wanted to have farm animals, but there is health and safety issues, of course, with livestock on the podium.
We have a big piece of new technology to make riding on the pavé and having a romantic relationship with the pavé easier. They're called mind gears.
Mind gears?
It is the changing of the gears. First you had the mechanical changing of the gears, and then you have the electronics. And now, by the power only of the mind, you change gears. Therefore, you do not need to replace the hands from the handlebars anywhere. You just use your power of the mind to change the gears. And Bonin already is trying it, but maybe not so successfully. It is in the early stages of development.
So that could be a decisive factor.
For the Paris-Roubaix and for Flanders next year, I think that the mind gears will be in production. I am talking to many people at the moment, but fundamentally, the difficult thing about mind gears is the rider has to have the power of telekinesis. And at the moment, there are not too many riders with telekinesis, but we keep looking.
People have been asking about the sheepdog.
Did you find it?
Yeah, I just said yes, because I just...
You wanted a happy ending.
Yeah, you know, I'm sure it's fine.
Thanks for downloading this edition of the Ruler podcast. You can read Ruler magazine, which comes out 8 times a year, by taking out a subscription. Go to www.ruler.cc. Or you can pick up the latest edition at a growing number of bookshops and bike shops. If you've got an iPad, you can read the magazine on the iPad. Not only the current issue, but a handful of back issues as well. You'll find it in the Apple bookstore.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.